Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
We are not alone.
And a very, very good evening to everyone out there. This is Contact, and I'm your host, Leslie Mitchell-Clark, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Wes Roberts. Good evening, Wes. How are you doing?
Hey, Leslie. I'm doing very well, thank you.
Excellent. Well, we are extremely excited this evening because we are welcoming back to the show Mr. Len Kasten, who is certainly a noted author, UFO researcher, and a freelance feature writer. And anyone who has been researching or interested in the world of ufology would have to be aware of Len's two exceptional and, dare I say it, seminal books dealing with ufology and ET contact. And those would, of course, be The Secret History of Extraterrestrials, a personal favorite of mine, and the book that we're going to probably focus the most on today, Secret Journey to Planet Serpo, A True Story of Interplanetary Travel. And before we get going with Len, I want to read a couple of quotes about both of his books that'll give you, in the listening audience out there, a sort of a focus on how important these tomes are. And this first quote is, Len Kasten's The Secret, A History of Extraterrestrials provides an indispensable key to unlocking the hidden history of the extraterrestrial presence on our planet. The scope and implications of Kasten's book are breathtaking, not because of some sleight of hand by an ambitious author, but because of the greater reality that he unveils of extraterrestrials historically interacting with humanity. And that quote is from another person who's done our show, the wonderful Michael Sala, who is, of course, a PhD, and he's the founder and president of the Exopolitics Institute. And the second quote I would like to read to you is, I cannot overemphasize the importance of this book, Secret Journey to Planet Serpo. Kasten has cast the bright light of scholarship on a subject that cries for understanding and will change our world and everything that we have come to believe about ourselves and our place in the universe. The shocking truth is, we are not alone, and we have never been alone. And that quote comes from Robert Dean, of course, Commander Sergeant Major of the U.S. Army. And just a further footnote that I would like to read to you is just a very, very brief recap of what Secret Journey to Planet Serpo focuses on for our listeners out there who were not fortunate to hear Mr. Kasten the last time he visited us. In brief, on July 16, 1965, a massive alien spacecraft from the Zeta Reticular System landed at a Nevada test site north of Las Vegas. Following a plan set in motion by President Kennedy in 1962, the alien visitors known as the Ebens welcomed 12 astronaut-trained military personnel aboard their craft for the 10-month journey to their home planet, Serpo, located 39 light-years away. In November 2005, former and current members of the Defense Intelligence Agency, the DIA, who had been directed by Kennedy to organize the Serpo Exchange Program, came forward to reveal the operation, including details from the 3,000-page debriefing of the 7 members of the Serpo team who had returned following 13 years on the planet. Working with the DIA originators of the Serpo project and the diary kept by the expedition's commanding officer, Len Kasten has chronicled the complete journey of these cosmic pioneers, including their remarkable stories of life on the alien planet, superluminal space travel, and advanced alien technologies. Exposing the Truth of Human-Alien Interaction and Interplanetary Travel, Kasten reveals that not only have the Ebens returned to Earth numerous times, but also that the U.S. government continues to have an ongoing relationship with them, a relationship with the potential to advance the human race to an astounding future. And with all of that, I apologize for being long-winded. I am thrilled to welcome back to the program Len Kasten. Len, how are you? Good evening.
Good evening, Leslie. It's great to be with you.
Thank you so much. And before we jump into the, you know, the real meat and potatoes of the SERPO Journey and Exchange Program, there was some fascinating background included in Secret Journey to Planet SERPO that we didn't really examine on your last visit with us, partly because I think I was uncomfortable with some of the material, because certainly it focused on the Nazi space program, their relationship with the Greys and the Draconians or Reptilians, and how very, very close we came to actually not winning the Second World War. So if we could just talk for a very brief moment about the relationship between Karl Haushofer, who, as I understand it, was sent by the German government in 1908, sent to Japan to be schooled in their military training.
Actually, it was the opposite. They sent him to school the Japanese military in the use of artillery and Prussian military discipline. They wanted him as a contact. But I thought it was important. I wrote that section of the book because I thought it was very important to set the stage for what followed, namely the fact that the Nazis did have that advanced technology, and we encountered that technology in Antarctica, and that's why the contact with the Ebens was so important to us, because it allowed us to catch up with the anti-gravity disc technology.
Indeed, and of course the Germans had developed Der Glock and goodness knows what else, and the idea that there was the establishment of a Nazi colony of Aryans in Antarctica, and they actually believed that, you know, following a polar shift, a predictable polar shift, that Antarctica would once again be a green, lush land, and they would be able to control the entire world with the help of their ET friends, which I believe includes the Greys, the classic Greys, which are not more like automatons, of course, but the masters of the Greys would be the Draconians, who have been involved with us since perhaps the very beginning of our history. And notably, Haushofer was engaged in some sort of contact with a Draconian cell underground in Tibet called, I believe, the Green Men.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm. He was actually in touch with the Green Dragons. The Green Men actually were a very, very occult and hidden group. That they were sort of the masters of the Green Dragons.
Interesting. And ultimately, what happened to Haushofer, this individual who really was involved in the selection of Hitler, an unstable personality, as the masthead of this Nazi regime?
He thought he had found the person that the Green Dragons were looking for, and he helped him write Mein Kampf. He wrote all the sections on geopolitics while Hitler was in jail, and he really became the mastermind of the whole Nazi movement, and was primarily responsible for elevating Hitler to power.
Mm-hmm. And Len, do you believe that that both Eisenhower and Churchill knew about this this ET Nazi collaboration and this colony that they were trying to establish in Antarctica?
I don't think they knew that, but they knew about the fact that the Germans were getting this anti-gravity technology. They did not really know where it was coming from.
Mm-hmm. I see. So let's move up in history just a little bit. And now, as I understand it from your book, although the Ebens had been visiting us in a benevolent way, you know, probably since the dawn of time, The real story of Planet Serpo begins with the Roswell crash.
Right, that's correct. Two of their craft collided northwest of Roswell, and we recovered one of them immediately, what was left of it, and we recovered the second one 2 years later, about 100 miles west of Roswell. We did not know the second one was there for all that time.
Mm-hmm. And were we responsible for discombobulating the anti-grav of their, I assume, their small scout ships? Certainly it wasn't a mothership. Were we responsible for bringing them down, or was it purely an accident?
Well, it was a very strong lightning storm that night also to complicate the situation. And our radar over that particular base, which was a 509th bomb group, which was a nuclear missile delivery bomb group, was very very unique. And I think all those conditions combined is what caused their craft to collide over Roswell.
I see. Now we, of course, call these beings involved in the Roswell crash and other crashes too. We refer to them as Ebens, which is really, I believe, extra biological entities. And they are not Greys, not to be confused with Greys. They are more, they would more easily be described as small humans, not unlike the beings that Betty and Barney Hill encountered, although the Ebens have not been involved in abductions, as I understand. Now, the Ebens, their home planet, or rather their new home planet, is called Serpo, and I believe it's located in the Zeta Reticuli system, and so it must be a binary star system. And tell us a little bit about the Ebens, if you can. Are they a hybrid race? Are they genetically related to us in any way? And what seems to be their fascination or their interest in us as beings if we are not related somehow?
Well, they apparently have been journeying throughout the galaxy. They have been watching us for about at least 2,000 years and coming here without our knowledge. They just are roamers. They roam the galaxy, and they found us to be interesting, and they watched us develop slowly. And then came the crash at Roswell, at which point we then met them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the entire history.
And they were survived. Now, I know that there were casualties, but one of the primary survivors, or maybe the survivor of the Roswell crash, was an individual that is referred to as EBE-1, who was really the individual who began the communication process with the beings from Serpo, where there began to be exchanges and attempts to understand language and the alphabet. He wrote out the Eben alphabet, and so he was really probably the most important being in this entire story.
Yeah, it was fortunate that one of the Ebens did survive the crash, and that was the key. That was the link. That brought us together with their civilization.
Mm-hmm.
If that hadn't happened, if he hadn't survived, none of this would have been possible.
Indeed. Now, he did not, sadly, he did not survive terribly long, as I understand it.
5 years.
5 years. And what was his passing, do you think, due to injuries that he had sustained, or just an incompatibility with being able to stay on our planet for a long period of time?
Probably all of those things. We found out they do live much longer than us on their home planet. So it's very likely that he would have lived a longer life if he hadn't been here. And I think we did everything possible that we could come up with to keep him happy and healthy. Evidently, you know, it didn't work.
Yes, I'm sure there were many factors that we simply could not have been aware of, and that they could not communicate to us at that time, because it took some years before the languages were really mutually understood. I found it very interesting that in your book you mentioned that the Eben language has no verbs. So imagine trying to establish sophisticated concepts of time, place, and location, et cetera, without the use of verbs.
Exactly, but they did pick up the English very well. Otherwise, we could not understand their language at all.
Yes,
their language was impossible. It was described as high pitched singing.
Yeah.
And at one point, the commander said it sounded like a screaming match when they were talking to each other.
Or a Corktown Saturday night. So.
Yeah.
Now I think if and I don't know how you feel about this, Len, but the Ray Centilli, what's become known as the Ray Centilli film footage, or what we would better know as Alien Autopsy. Now, there is some thinking that the being that is being dissected in this disturbing film is an Eben, but not from the Roswell crash, from, I believe it's the Corona crash?
No, that entity that's being autopsied in that film is from the crash that occurred in May. That was 2 months before Roswell, and they were an entirely different species.
Oh, I see.
You can see in the film that they have six fingers and toes. They're taller, and they look more human than the Ebens do. The Ebens do not look very human, really. They look like very small. They look like small, perhaps natives from the islands, but they don't look as human as that particular entity from that
was
covered.
Well, there are so many. I mean, in the recent disclosure hearings, you know, our own the Honorable Paul Hellyer, former defense minister of Canada, they're stating that they have been able to validate 82 different species who regularly visit us, and many of them are very similar looking.
Right, that's correct. But but our relationship with the Ebens was very important because they gave us the anti-gravity technology, and that was the key. That was the key to everything.
Yes, yes. Now it's 1965, Len, and this is the year of the incredible interstellar exchange program that is really the meat and potatoes of your book. And it might be interesting to point out, I think, that this was President Kennedy's desire that this exchange program would occur. And President Kennedy was certainly a controversial figure, and in that, you know, he was the creator of the DIA, which, if I'm not mistaken, was really designed to be an umbrella organization for a number of military, specifically aeronautical arms, and the idea that it was going to become a transparent organization. So this certainly puts into focus why certain members of the emerging military-industrial complex would not want Kennedy to continue as president. And that's, of course, a whole other subject. But it was under Kennedy's auspices that that the Interstellar Exchange Program actually came into being.
Yes, that's correct. He inherited it, actually. The deal was made much earlier while EBE number one was alive. And then afterwards, our scientists at Los Alamos continued the conversation and made the arrangements for the exchange program. But Kennedy was the one that had to set it in motion when he became president, and he agreed to it, of course.
Indeed. And when we talk about the exchange program, now, for any of our listeners out there, I imagine it's probably most of them, who have seen Close Encounters of the Third Kind, there's a very elaborate sequence near the end of the film. The original film, it was short. The long form, it's 20 minutes, where a group of pilgrims, of astronauts, are loaded onto a mothership for the very same type of exchange program that happened in reality. And in reality, it was 12 brave astronauts. I believe that there was originally it was 100 and something that were selected for the program. And of course, these individuals who were going to participate in this exchange, it was desired that they had as little family ties as possible. They could be married, but they couldn't have children. They preferred that they be orphans. And what were some of the other prerequisites, would you say, in finding these brave individuals who would make this journey?
Well, they didn't want them to be married either, if possible. They didn't want them to have any family ties at all. They were what they call sheep dipped in the military military uses. That's the term they use to strip off their identities, and then they were given new identities in the form of 3-digit numbers, and they became known as those 3-digit numbers throughout the entire adventure.
Mm-hmm. Although they did refer to each other by nicknames, which I thought were very amusing, because they had to do with popular culture.
Right, exactly. One became Dr. Sky, I think it was. I can't
Sky
recall.
King.
Sky King.
Sky
right.
King and his daughter Penny. My
yeah,
fantasy
right.
is a girl that I could just take off in a plane with my dad. That's every girl's fantasy, by the way.
Okay, well. Yeah, that was appropriate. Then that's exactly right. He became Sky King. The commander became Skipper, and there was Doc 1 and Doc 2 for the two doctors and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't going to go around calling each other by 3-digit numbers.
Yeah.
Although in all the communications and in the diaries, they were referred to by the 3-digit identities.
Indeed. And we should probably mention at this point that the information that you have so painstakingly and in such a marvelous detailed way included in your book really comes from a source who is known as Anonymous. And this individual, Anonymous, wrote in 2000, well, actually between 2005 and 2013, he began writing letters to Victor Martinez, who, of course, we all know as the founder of the UFO Thread List, which is a very important ufology tool. So these letters are really these letters from Anonymous are really the spine of the experience. Is that correct, Len?
Yeah, that's correct. There were 21 initial emails to Victor that revealed the entire story. And they became the crux of the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
It was elaborated on later by other members of the UFO Thread List who also knew about the program. And they fleshed out the entire entire website with a lot more information that added to the whole story.
And this project was by the military called Project Crystal Knight, as I understand. And is Anonymous still living?
We believe that he is, because there was the last email he sent in was in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
So there's reason to believe that he probably is still alive. Yes.
And he would have to be. A very elderly man at this point.
Well, if he was active in the actual program itself, which took place in the 60s, let's assume he was in his 30s at that point. So he would be quite old, yes.
Yes.
Point.
And now there were, of the 12 who were selected and traveled to Serpo and were there for 13 years, only 7 returned. Is that correct?
That's correct, yeah.
And what kinds of, perhaps our listeners would like to know, what kinds of things happened to this team? How did we lose so many of them? I know that one was lost even in transit on the way there.
Yes, he suffered a pulmonary embolism on the way to the planet, to planet Serpo, which was, by the way, a 10-month journey.
Mm.
Yes, and then 2 others died on Serpo about 3 years into the program. And then two decided to remain there. So that's why 7 returned.
So 2 could be there to this day under the perhaps sophisticated medical technology that they have.
It's possible. The last communication that we had with them was in 1988, which was... 10 years after the others had returned.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Now the flight, the trip to Serpo itself. This is part of the book that I really enjoy, because it really points to even with the use of superluminal travel, these journeys are arduous, even for the beings that make them regularly. As you pointed out, it's a 10-month journey by our calendar. But there seem to be they seem to be using wormholes, if I'm not mistaken. And I believe also that the astronauts themselves were in some type of a chair device. They were in chair devices, which were then encased in a kind of a plastic bubble of some sort, at which point they went into what we could probably refer to as a cryonic state or a sleep state.
Well, they could sleep or they could be awake at whatever they wanted to inside the bubble. I imagine that the bubble also contained a bed of some sort, as well as a chair, but they were told to stay inside the bubble during the critical parts of the journey.
And especially, why do you think that... Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Lynn.
Especially when they went through the time wave or the wormhole, at which point they became very ill if they left the bubble. So the Eben contact, the Voyage contact, told them to stay in the bubble while they were going through the time wave.
Mm-hmm. And so did the Eben seem to be unaffected by the time wave?
Yes, they did. They apparently were immune to the whole problem because, first of all, the physiology was totally different than ours, so they didn't react the same way for that reason.
Mm-hmm. And that probably might have been one of the reasons why when we were attempting to reverse engineer their craft before the exchange program occurred, some of our scientists went on board the craft and became disoriented and ill, and their memories were affected, and they were hearing a low hum of some sort, which seems to point to some type of a vibrational component in their propulsion system.
Yeah, that's correct. That was the craft that landed at Kingman, Arizona, intact, completely intact, and that was the craft they gave to us to reverse engineer. Mm-hmm. And when we sent our people into the landed craft, they got sick. And one of the persons who was in that group was asked if he would re-enter the craft later, and he said, "I'd rather take a rocket ship to hell than to go back inside that craft." So evidently there was some very severe reactions.
Indeed. Well, we are, if we can, as human beings, simple 10-cycle sound can disrupt us and cause paranoia and vomiting and, EMF emanations, if they're high enough, can do the same thing, it makes perfect sense that any type of vibration that isn't compatible with our physiology could cause all of these situations.
Yeah, that's correct. There's so much we don't know about space travel, but we learned a lot in that journey, and fortunately that we have that information now.
Indeed. And now, upon landing on the planet, first of all, I found it fascinating that you mentioned that all of the equipment that the 12 astronauts had brought with them, which was something like 45 tons of equipment. It included, three jeeps and handguns and goodness knows what type of scientific equipment. All of that stuff was essentially easily placed on one floor of this massive mothercraft. And then when it came time to unload, it was essentially levitated out of the cargo hold into some type of Eben conveyance.
That's correct, yeah. They did it in one move. They moved all of that equipment in one move. So evidently they had anti-gravity capabilities for doing something like that. And we learned that later when we got on their planet, that they did indeed have anti-gravity. All of their vehicles operated that way, and they used it every day.
Mm-hmm. And again, we're talking about vibration. Isn't it perfectly reasonable to assume that when we look at the great megalithic structures of our Earth, the Bosnian Pyramid now, 60,000 years old, the everything from Iron Age megaliths to more contemporary ones, that in fact anti-grav technology must have been utilized by our own people, by our own Earth beings.
That's correct. I think we've had this technology on and off over a long period of time. And evidently it's common knowledge throughout the galaxy how to do that using electromagnetic technology. That's how it's done.
Mm-hmm.
The electromagnetic technology essentially creates its own gravity wave, which, just like two magnets, repel each other. and when they get close to the gravity of the Earth or the whatever planet they're on, and the two repel each other, so the craft is able to literally counteract gravity.
And Len, what was the planet, or what is the planet Serpo like? And as I understand it, it is not actually the true home of the Ebens, but a home that they fled to following some type of massive military conflict.
Well, no, the reason they left had to do with volcanic action on their planet.
Ah.
They had to leave their planet about 5,000 years prior to our visit there. So they'd been living there about 5,000 years when we did the exchange program. But they did have a war in their past, and it was a very, very long and violent one.
Mm. Was it a war amongst their own peoples, a kind of a civil war, or?
No, it was with another civilization, and evidently it was because of that experience that they kept a sort of a police state on their own planet because of that experience.
Mm.
That was a long and brutal war, and they were able to win it finally using particle beam technology.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds just as horrific as some of the things that our nation and our world have been through, the tremendous loss of life. And so they were determined to maintain peace, and one of the ways that they were doing that was through, you know, if you will, a martial law kind of situation.
Exactly.
And the planet itself, how did our astronauts as human beings adapt to the geology, the ecosystems of the planet? What was it like? Was it deserty, or is it deserty?
Well, they landed at the equatorial region, which was a very, very hot climate there, and they were naturally very uncomfortable while they were in that part of the planet. But they kept them in an underground quarters, and that helped a lot, helped them keep cool that way.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have anything like what we would call air conditioning, from what I gather from the emails.
Ah.
But eventually, as they explored the planet, they learned that the quadrant they called Quadrant 1 was very pleasant and very Earth-like. In fact, they referred to it as Little Montana. And after 7 years in the equatorial region, the Ebens built a small community for them in that area, in that region, and
oh,
so
wow.
they were able to be relatively comfortable
wow.
for the last 7 years of the habitation.
So the Ebens had a real understanding of how, you know, the heat was just much more difficult for us than
oh,
it
yeah.
was for them.
Oh yeah, sure, yeah. They understood that. Yeah,
they got that. And now I'm very fascinated by the female being that you refer to, or is referred to as EBE2, because just like on our planet, some people had apparently linguistic facility, and some people not so much, and it didn't necessarily have to do with their education or whether they were scientists or what have you, but this female being had achieved a tremendous level of facility with English.
Yeah, that's correct. And she became the very important liaison for our team while they were on Serpo.
Mm-hmm.
She was their guide. She was their hostess. She was their interpreter. She was very critical to the whole operation.
Mm-hmm. And I think we chatted briefly about this last time you were on the show, but there is a section in the book that I find so moving, and it had to do... perhaps you can take it from here, but it had to do with the death of one of the team members. It was very emotional. I'm not sure what happened, but the individual was not able to be revived or healed. And when the Ebens understood that, they really began a mourning process in sympathy with our team.
Yes, and apparently... This had some. They were able to offer that because the first person that had died en route to Serpo, which was referred, he was referred to as 308. He was actually one of the pilots. They took the body and started experimenting with it, and our commander, became very incensed when he learned that they had more or less carved up the body and used it for their cloning operations. So when the second person died, now that they knew how upset the Americans were, they were very careful to give it a much more deferential treatment.
Mm-hmm. And there was a sequence that you describe about the Ebens, I believe, singing, or you know, singing a dirge or some type of song of mourning, if you will, and it just went on and on and on for some very long period of time.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, we had found out before we even sent the team there that they had an interest in chanting, like Tibetan chants. We knew about that. We knew that before the trip. We had a lot of information before the trip, and so we sent some of the tapes we sent with the team were Tibetan chants, and I think they appreciated the fact that, that we understood their musical interests.
Mm-hmm. So that's very interesting that they were sympathetic, and they did understand mourning and loss, and certainly any peoples who had passed through a war, they would have a deep understanding of mourning and loss. But the natural lifespans of the Ebens are quite extensive compared to ours. Is that correct? Maybe hundreds of years, or
yes, several hundred years.
Mm. And do they reproduce in the same way that we do? Did they live in family units, and did our team ever see any Eben children?
Yes, we did. They did. They lived in small houses or huts, what you like to call it, very modest dwellings. And our team did snoop around a lot, even though they were told to respect the privacy of the Ebens. They did learn how they reproduced and that it was similar to ours. And they were allowed to have only two children.
Hmm. How Chinese.
Exactly, yeah.
Interesting. Interesting that they were controlling their population, even though their population had been so decimated.
It had been, yeah. They only had supposedly around 650,000 people when our team went there.
And within the Eben society, where they're, although, you know, they're all, everyone's under martial law, were there strata of society? In other words, as we have like unskilled labor all the way up to people with giant brains like Stephen Hawking, did they have a strata like that where the homes were different? Or I guess I'm saying, was it kind of like communism, or in fact, is it a little bit more like what our system?
Well, it was certainly more like communism in the sense that they didn't have to worry about buying things. They had no money. They just went to a central repository, could take whatever they wanted. So they didn't have to work to earn money to acquire goods as we do. Mm-hmm. They were given everything they wanted. However, they were expected to work, and each one did have a specialty, and they were trained in their specialty before, in what we would call perhaps colleges or whatever, higher education.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I guess we would assume that there were different levels of IQ and people suited to different things, but it wasn't really a status maker or breaker. It was just the reality of how their society functions.
Exactly. We determined, I don't know how exactly, we determined that their average IQ was about 160 in our terms.
Excellent.
So they were all very smart. And that's how they were able to learn English, whereas we could not learn their language.
Mm. So the average Eben had about double the IQ of George Bush, is what you're saying.
You want to put it that way.
Sorry, I just had to get that in there. I apologize. I've been incensed thinking about Barry Goldwater since we talked yesterday. So.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, and what about their spirituality? Now, there are, you know, it's from many of the experts that have appeared on this show, and much of what you hear in the world of ufology. You know, we talk about beings who are in various levels of density. Now, it sounds as if the Ebens, you know, they're functioning in the third density in the physical reality. So it's, we can talk to them, we can interact with them, we can touch them. But do they have a monotheistic or polytheistic concept of God or gods?
They believe in something that what they would call the creator, similar to our God, but that's as far as it went. I do have a chapter on their religious beliefs
mm-hmm.
in the book, and they also believed in reincarnation,
mm.
that they did have souls, and the souls could migrate to another body after their death. So from that standpoint, they were similar to us in a lot of ways.
Yeah, very much so, and especially, you know, the wheel of karma. That's fascinating. I wonder if they believed that it's possible to incarnate into bodies of beings of different species.
Well, I think with their level of understanding, and they probably did understand that, yes. Although they were probably not as sophisticated in that regard as are the grays that we encounter in our abduction scenarios.
Mm-hmm. Well, the gray, mercifully, in my work as a hypnotherapist, I do have a large number of individuals that I work with who have had abduction experiences. But one thing that we seem to be seeing is these particularly odious, invasive, experimental experiences that people have had with the grays don't seem to be occurring at the present time. They I don't know if there is a moratorium or if I'm not certain exactly why this is, but the kinds of experiences that people tend to be having now or as adults tend to be more collaborative and even sometimes occurring in what we would call the etheric body, not necessarily in the physical density.
Well, I think that the grays and the reptilians are both basically fourth-dimensional entities.
Mm-hmm.
That's where they are most comfortable. And I think it takes a lot of energy for them to interact with us in the third dimension.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe at this point, the hybrid program has advanced far enough so that they don't need to abduct as many women and create hybrid creatures. And now it's more of an interaction on a spiritual, perhaps, and a mental level.
Indeed, that seems to be the case. I don't know if you've been following, since we last talked, there's been a lot of information out there, and basically everything corroborates, with things that appear in your two excellent books. But Randy Kramer, Captain K, he's known by, is an individual who claims to have participated in what we would call a kind of a black ops military space program where he was billeted on Mars for some 17 years, something like that. Now, Randy Kramer says that one of the reasons that the gray abductions no longer occur in the way that they have is that those particular grays that were most involved in that behavior had a base on the moon. I think it's Phobos outside of Mars, and that our own Mars Defense Force went to the Phobos moon and just bombed the gray base into smithereens.
Oh, okay. That's information I did not know about that. That's very interesting.
Yeah, so that, in a way, there's a part of me that almost hopes it's true, you know, but for whatever reason, we don't see nearly as much of that. Len, could you tell us a little bit about the famous Yellow Book? And now we're backtracking a wee bit again to the interactions that took place before the exchange program. But we were gifted, or our military were gifted with something called the Yellow Book, which came from the Ebens.
Yeah, before we discuss the Yellow Book, I just wanted to point out one other thing regarding the landings.
Yes.
You may be familiar, you probably are familiar with the Lonnie Zamora incident.
Of course.
You know that particular incident occurred on April 24th, 1964, mm-hmm. in northern New Mexico. That New Mexico police officer encountered a landed craft with two entities standing next to it. Do you remember that? Have you read about that?
Yes, I do indeed.
Well, that was the craft that the Eben sent that missed its point.
Ah.
Landed in the wrong place.
Mm.
And that was the whole Lonnie Zamora incident.
Ah. So that, in fact, was the... Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense, because as you state, there was a lot of confusion in the beginning in the communications with figuring out points of departure or meeting points or what have you.
Exactly. The coordinates, their mathematics were somewhat different from ours. In any case, that validates the fact that first craft did land and did miss its point. It then took off and found the right place at the Holloman Air Force Base.
Wow.
In any case, when they landed that first time in April, that became more or less the ceremonial landing, and that's when they presented us with the Yellow Book.
Ah.
And the Yellow Book was translated by that female entity, EBE number 2. And it was an entire history of our planet. And it was really a very, very special gift to the planet Earth.
Incredible. Was it holographic, Len? Or was it just a literal book with pages, or did it have special properties, or was it visual, or
the way it was described by Anonymous? It was a block of material, approximately 2.5 inches thick and transparent in nature and appearance. The reader looks at the transparent surface and suddenly words and pictures appear. It is an endless series of historical stories and photographs of our universe, the Eben planet and their former homeworld, and other interesting stories about the universe. It also contains a historical narrative and various accounts about Earth's history and our distant past. So that was the way it was described by Anonymous. And he says, to this day, I am one of the very few people who has actually seen and read the Yellow Book. As has been commented on by others, it would take a lifetime to read it and another lifetime to understand it.
Mm. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Yes. Now, Wes, I believe you had a question for Len.
Yes, I've been making copious notes. This is my normal routine. what I wanted to ask you, Len, was I'm thinking about the distillation of, say, 100 people down to 12 people. And I'm thinking about all sorts of things like the physical capabilities of these people, but in particular, the psychological preparation. And I'm thinking, I don't know that I could survive life in a bubble for 10 months. Can you elaborate a little bit, to the extent you know, on the psychological impact or preparation?
Well, I'm sure that first half of the journey was very traumatic for them. But they were all military trained. They were not astronauts, but they were trained. They were all military people. But then around the halfway point, they could leave the bubbles and wander around the ship in any way they wanted to. And it became a much more pleasant experience at that point. And they were able to see the propulsion system, the control system, and interact more with the Evens on board the craft. So then it became a much better trip.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that we knew before we sent the astronauts that there was going to be a sort of disorienting part of the trip in that way, where they would be restricted into these bubbles? And And certainly were these candidates tested for, I suppose, claustrophobia, the same way you would look at guys who were going to go on a submarine mission?
Absolutely. They were given a very intense claustrophobic experience, where they were buried in a box about 5 feet underground, I believe, and with just some food and water, and they had to stay there for 7 days.
Oh. My hands are sweating right now. Even the idea of this is blowing my little brain right
out. I know. Now, if they had any trace of claustrophobia, they certainly would have cracked up.
Indeed. Yeah. Now, there seems to be some confusion about women included on the among the 12 astronauts, if you will. Some were there, in fact. I think there were supposed to be two women. Somebody says they scrubbed out. Were there women included in the final grouping?
No, the way I understand, there was some controversy about this, and the way I understand it is that 16 people were selected, not 12. They selected four alternates to be trained alongside the original 12, and then after the training of 16, that's when they narrowed it down to the 12.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what happened was that there were two women in the original group of 16, but they decided to make it an all male trip.
Mm-hmm.
After the actual selection of the 12.
I see.
So I think there were only 12 men who went on the trip.
And while our astronauts were living on Serpo, were they able to eventually get a taste for the local cuisine, or did everything continue to taste like paper, as they said on the journey?
Well, the sea rations they took with them, I think, lasted about 5 years. After that, they had to depend on the even food, and they said it tasted like paper, but they eventually got accustomed to it. There was some fruit-like food that they liked, and they got used to it. And so the last part of the trip, they actually did live on even food.
Wow. Did the on Planet Serpo, were the Ebens exclusively vegetarian, or was there local game to hunt? Was meat a part of our astronauts' diet?
No, it wasn't. And at one point, they encountered a snake-like creature, and they killed that snake, which the Ebens did not want them to do it, but they did it anyway, and they ate some of that creature, but the Ebens were very revolted by the fact that they had to do that.
Oh.
So they apparently were strictly vegetarian.
I see. Very interesting. Very interesting. Wow. Well, they must not have had O negative blood then. So.
I don't. Is that what happens with O negative blood?
Oh, apparently. I don't know how much credibility I put in it, but you know, the big fad thing was eat for your blood type. You know, a few years ago, and the statement was that those with O negative blood were actually people who are very closely descended from the Anunnaki, who were big time meat eaters. So
right.
It's necessary for us to keep from being anemic to have some meat sometimes. Now I have O negative blood, but I found other ways to get that iron that I need. So.
Are you a vegetarian or a vegan?
I'm not can't go quite to that vegan level because I'm really into cheese, frankly. But yeah, I'm a vegetarian. I do eat fish though. So there you go. So Len, at this current time, right now in our troubling political times, are we now still having contact with the Ebens? Can they help us with diplomacy or to establish peace, or even on the dark side, using weapons that are not nuclear that can in fact subdue the violent elements in the Middle East?
We have tremendous technology that's being hidden. Much of it given to us by the Ebens. I think we do have particle beam weapons. I have no doubt about that. And we do have anti-gravity. We know that for sure. We probably have free energy as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think all of those things were given to us, but our particular economical masters who are running the economy choose not to give it to us right now.
Yeah.
And but as far as weaponry goes, we have weapons that are beyond belief now.
Yes.
And we choose not to use them unless absolutely necessary, I believe.
Indeed. Well, you know, part of this issue of the military-industrial complex, you know, I think you would probably agree. I mean, this again goes back to Roswell, and you know, which is clearly illustrated in Corso's book about how, in the attempts to reverse engineer alien technology, it was parceled out to various industrialists, you know, Lockheed, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then unfortunately, you know, they liked the profit margin, and we really lost any kind of control of being able to deliver this technology to our population.
Exactly. I think the most critical area of technology in which we have developed a lot of expertise has to do with biotechnology.
Mm-hmm.
We learned on SERPO that the aliens could clone individuals.
Mm.
In fact, they did clone the parts, using the parts of the body of 308. They did clone a creature that looked like half human and half even.
Oh wow!
And they did that in the short time that the team was there.
Yes.
So that technology we now must have.
Yes.
I mean, it seems logical since they were so free to share with us all of their secrets. They didn't keep anything back.
Yes.
And they've been back here 9 times now.
Yeah.
I think we probably have that capability, and I think it's slowly emerging, but very slowly.
Yes, all too slowly. Well, Len, I can hardly believe it, but the hour has just slipped away. I mean, this should be a 12-part miniseries. We did want to mention, Len, that you are going to be appearing and here in Canada at the Alien Cosmic Expo, which is happening June 26th, 27th, and 28th in Brantford, Ontario. This is an all-star event. Len Kasten is going to be a featured speaker. Stanton Friedman, Paul Hellyer, Jason Martel, the list goes on and on. I don't think we've ever had an event like this in Canada previously, so it's going to be quite something. And tickets are available. They're going fast, like hotcakes on a Friday night, but they're available. So please do log on to aliencosmicexpo.com. Get your tickets now, and Mr. Len Kasten will be there. And I'll get to introduce you, Len, which I'm looking forward to.
Oh, yeah, great. I'm looking forward to it also.
All right. So thank you, Len Kasten. Thank you for this incredible work that you have done, providing this information, which is adding to everyone's illumination and also giving us a lot of hope for the future. Now, what is the best way to reach you, Len, or to find out more about your books?
Well, I do have a website. It's et-secrethistory. And through my website, you can either order the book directly, or you can click through to Amazon or Barnes & Noble and order it that way, or through the publisher itself. And I do have some other things on the website that may be of interest to your listeners, like videos that I selected that support the entire technology and operation.
Wonderful. Well, thank you, Len Kasten, for joining us again. And it's been an illuminating, absorbing conversation. And we look forward to reconnecting you at the Alien Cosmic Expo. And would a drink be out of the question at that time?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
Good to hear it. Thank you, Len Kasten. All right, you have
a drink of your choice.
All right. Well, I think we'll call it Even Punch, whatever it is.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Len.
Okay, my pleasure. Take care.
We appreciate it. Take care. Okay, bye-bye now. And folks, we're going to sign off from Contact. This is your host, Leslie Mitchell-Clark, and of course, Wes Roberts. And we appreciate you joining us for this marvelous conversation with Len Kasten. And remember, we are not alone. Good night, everyone.
Good night.